Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jim Shepherds, and let me give you a brief bio for him first, bio sketch. Jim Shepherds is a native of Nebraska, where he grew up on an irrigated grain and livestock farm. He received his BS degree in 1968 in agricultural honors and his MS in soil chemistry in 1970 from the University of Nebraska. He earned a PhD in soil physical chemistry from the University of Illinois in 1973. Upon graduation, he taught soil physics and conducted irrigation research at the University of Georgia before returning to Nebraska. And from 1975 to 2008, he was employed with the USDA ARS, Agricultural Research Service, where he worked to develop technologies to help producers reduce nitrate losses to groundwater, including remote sensing and active canopy sensors. He retired in 2008 and holds the rank of Professor Emeriti in Agronomy and Horticulture Department from the University of Nebraska. That's the bio sketch Jim sent me, but taking the liberty of adding a few more things myself. Dr. Shepherds is a fellow of the ASA and the SSSA, also the winner of the Warner L. Nelson Diagnosis of Yield Limiting Factors Award, the SSSA Soil Science Applied Research Award, and the SSSA Soil Science Professional Service Award. Furthermore, I wanted to note a few key thrusts where Dr. Shepherds was really a leader and groundbreaking soil scientist in these last 30 years. The first I would say is that Jim was one of the first to integrate water management and quality within fertilizer and manure management. And this would lead to his interest in site-specific precision ag. Again, with irrigation, look at sprinkler versus furrow. He was involved in the MESA project in Nebraska and Kansas and a variable rate nitrogen EPA project in the 90s. Second, I noted that Jim develops a sufficiency approach. The 95% of a well-fertilized nitrogen reference strip or plot area, first with a chlorophyll meter, and then that led to his expertise in remote sensing. His accomplishments there are many for nitrogen management, starting, I believe, maybe not exactly, but early on it was a Resource 21 agreement, and then moved to proximal sensing, passive sensors and active sensors, collaborated a lot with Bill Ron and Kyle Holland. Jim is also active in international work, especially in Brazil, where he spearheaded the LABEX program, which is the scientific exchange between EMPAVA and ARS. Jim was also active in Ukraine and made a lot of trips there in the context of remote sensing and GIS precision agriculture. Finally, I wanted to mention before I called him up that he was a mentor of a large number of graduate students and other younger scientists, myself included when I was young. And Jim, please.
That was too much. I look over the audience, I see so many friends, people that I've known, acquaintances. There's a tremendous amount of expertise out here, folks. And it's not what I'm going to say, it's what you have done. And so what I'm going to tell you what I hope the take-home lesson is to start with. It's the value of teams, of mentoring, of coaching, and being one of the players. We can't all be everything all the time, but I think that there's a place for everybody at different places. So I'm going to use some examples. And as I put this together, I use the internet quite a bit. I talked to some of you. And I ran across some things that I found were sort of interesting. So I'm a kind of a simple person, and some things that caught my attention. So I'm going to pass along some of those to start with. I'm going to start with these two guys, Haber and Bosch. And the reason I'm going to do that is if you attended the meetings 2 years, 3 years ago, Dave Kissel gave a presentation that started before Haber and Bosch, came up through some of the spirited discussions that occurred about the anhydrous ammonia development, the procedures to make the thing and get it commercialized. And this is still on the website with ASA. So the reason I mention it is so you can go back and listen to that. Dave presented lots and lots of trivia information that I found very interesting. And so I'm going to try to add to that a little bit as we go forward, and then try to share with you how I think we've got to where we are using some examples. At the end, I'll issue a couple of concerns and then end with some trivia. So you got to stay around for that. Anyway, for those of you who might not be familiar with the Haber-Bosch process, it was developed in a laboratory. Bosch was hired by BASF to commercialize it. So that happened in about 1913 or so. But it required a lot of pressure and a lot of temperature plus some catalyst. And so Dave Kissel's presentation talks about some of these problems they had. If you go to the end now, some of the things that are listed and identified on the internet, they say that, yes, it does require, it does use some of the natural gas. And as such, the outputs of that, though, are feeding a great number of people in the world. One of the statements was that nitrogen fertilizers produce the food to feed 48% of the current world population. Another one said that about half the world population would not be here today had it not been for the Haber-Bosch process. So we've talked about the beginning, we've talked about the end, now we're going to put some things in between. In terms of the U.S., back before World War II, most of the saltpeter, most of the nitrate used in ammunition was coming from Chile. But at the time of World War II, British ships ruled the seas, and so they shut off the supply of saltpeter to the Germans. And so the Germans had to fall back and make their own. And this is where Haber-Bosch came in. So they made their own. In the U.S., the first Haber-Bosch process was built in about mid-20s. And what I wanted to point out and found interesting was that USDA experimented using the Haber-Bosch process and the anhydrous ammonia back in 1933, but they concluded that it will never be commercially feasible because we have other sources of nitrogen. My friend Guy Swanson sent me this. It's a publication from the Mississippi Experiment Station, but it's an old-time picture. If you look at it, you can see an anhydrous ammonia applicator. OSHA wouldn't necessarily approve of riding on those tanks. Each one of those is about 20 gallon, not very big. And in some ways, the applicator with the seven knives going in the ground, going to require quite a bit of power. So they're pulling it there with a caterpillar. But this picture apparently was taken in 1943, long time ago. Today, some of those same storage devices are still scattered around the country. There's one in Nebraska that I'm aware of. When I was a little kid, we would drive up and down the road and we would talk about that big ball out there. And this was for anhydrous ammonia storage. It's located, this picture was taken in 2014, but it was taken near Aurora, Nebraska. It's still there, if you'd like to see it. But now we've learned that if you cool it, refrigerate this, you don't have to store it under pressure. So there's the circular ball was intended at that time because they didn't refrigerate it. So here we go. We're going to talk a little bit about this crude trail that I drew over there. But prior to World War II, there wasn't a lot of fertilizer used, commercial fertilizer used. A lot of it was The nitrogen was generated by mineralization or involving manures, composting, crop rotations, things like this. Those in the audience from John Deere, this is probably the only implement you never stood behind. Very interesting. And since that time, they've learned to not use red paint. So anyway, but I'm going to list a few names as we go through here. And if I have seen you here, I may mention your name. And if I don't mention your name and you're here, I'm sorry. But some of the old timers relative to nitrogen mineralization and cover crops, I've listed George Stanford, Joe Legg, Sam Smith, Frank Stevenson from Illinois, Jack Meisinger, he's still active, Ed Beltzville, Wilbur Fry, and the list goes on and on. But I just wanted to throw out some names that as you read the literature, you'll know what they did. So we're going to go on now. Back in the 40s, 30s, 40s, we talked about needing a procedure to manufacture anhydrous ammonia under high pressure, temperature, this sort of thing. So industry came along, and they were very helpful in developing better compressors, better catalysts, hydroelectric plants, this sort of thing, to make everything go smoother. Concurrent to this, today we heard some talks about N15 fertilizer. Well, part of this came from the atomic energy efforts, and so production of depleted and enriched N15 has helped us understand the dynamics of nitrogen. And I need to go back a little bit. At the time of World War II, back in 1916, there was a concern about being able to produce our own saltpeter. And so the government had made arrangements and had acquired the property on the Tennessee River to build hydroelectric plants for generating electricity and making anhydrous ammonia. The war ended so quickly that they never proceeded with it. They let much of the property go back, but in 1937, Congress authorized then the TVA. And it started out as the hydroelectric situation. They realized that they needed to have conservation practices to keep all the sediment from silting in the dams. Along the way, then, they said, we have to have nutrients also to increase the productivity of the land. And so this is where TVA came into play. Some of the products that were developed by TVA, development of urea and ammonium nitrate, dry fertilizers formulated with phosphorus, sulfur-coated urea, liquid fertilizers, blended fertilizers, products like ammonium thiosulfate. And one of the pictures that I found was this picture of the TVA facilities. I will mention that some of the people involved heavily in the N15 research was Roland Houck. Some of you may remember Roland. The other people that were involved in some of the research, people like Bert Bock. Bert is not here. But I talked to him yesterday, and he said, hello, say hello to everybody. But the caption at the bottom I found very interesting. TVA developed 75% of the fertilizers used worldwide today. But research and development in fertilizer technology have almost ceased since the program ceased in the early 1990s. And so we don't have much of that going on anymore. Well, after World War II, we no longer needed as much ammunition. The nitrogen fertilizer became available for agriculture, and so we had a major period of promotion, encouraging farmers to use fertilizer, and this went on and on, and it was complemented by, of course, the new fertilizers developed by TVA. But along the way, I wanted to show you this graph, and you've seen some of those before. This is the production or use of nitrogen over time. I'll point out one thing. 1993, that was an aberration in the data, but if you remember back, in a couple years before that, corn production had been very, very high yields. The government had lots and lots of corn in storage. They didn't have room for the next crop. And so they decided, well, rather than pay the farmers a subsidy, we'll just give them back some of the corn. And so farmers were issued a warehouse receipt so they could market the corn. And that freed up some storage the next year. Now the other concern was this rapid increase in nitrogen use and what it might be doing to the environment. Coming from Nebraska, one of our favorites, our people that remember, is Prof. Olson. And he was forever telling us, he says, this business of irrigation, more fertilizer, more of this, it's going to get you in trouble. And he was looking at groundwater quality, this sort of thing. One of his favorite sayings was, the soil is a lousy place to store nitrogen. Now, some of his graduate students are in they're here, I don't know if they're in the audience, Mike Russell, Bob Haved, Bill Ron, where'd Bill left? Bill Ron, Albert Sims, I'm sure they've all heard Prof. Olson talk about storing nitrogen. Going back to this thing a minute, I have to give this the marvels of modern technology will let you edit your presentation just a little while before. Fran Pierce is the one that pointed this out. He said, during this period of rapid nitrogen use and increase in yields and all this stuff, you remember back when they talked about maximum yields? Well, that didn't suit well with everybody, so we had to increase or put the word efficiency in there, make it work better. And now it's got to be sustainable, too. So these are some of the evolutions we've gone through using the same kind of data. This is total nitrogen consumption now. Now we're going to look at corn. Check out what happened in the early 1970s. All of a sudden, we started using a lot more nitrogen. There's a bit of that happening also the last few years. So being curious, and internet once again lets you get way back in and dig into some of this information. I thought, why is that happening? So this is now the price of corn. I thought, well, maybe the price of corn was up, people would apply more fertilizer. And sure enough, there was a jump in the price of corn back in the early 70s. And then we all remember what's happened in the last few years. The other concern is, well, if this is the case, how about the price of fertilizer? What was the influence there? Well, this is the cost and price of anhydrous ammonia. So you see some of the same jumpiness, especially at the end, the high prices of anhydrous ammonia. So what will happen if we put those together? We do a correlation. Here we go. Price of corn versus anhydrous ammonia. Not great, but not too bad either. I was talking to Greg Schwab this morning, and I'd heard that about 90% of the cost of anhydrous ammonia was tied up in the cost of natural gas. And so I checked it on the internet, and that's the upper limit. But so there's a good relationship. If you know the price of natural gas, you can sort of tell what to expect. But also there's the issue of, if farmers have good corn prices, everybody wants a piece of that. The seed companies, the herbicide companies, fertilizer companies, they all want their piece. Many times they forget that when the price of natural gas or the prices of seed go down, the value of corn, they forget about that business of increasing prices. And so the farmers ask to absorb these differences. Found this interesting, talking about where you live. This is the nitrogen now applied in Nebraska to corn. It's been pretty stable since 1968. The last few years have not provided data every year, so I didn't hook the lines together. But if you just go across the Missouri River where they have less irrigation, you see some of the same trends. They didn't get into the business of nitrogen applications quite as early. If you go a little further east where they have more rainfall, you'll see that the same kind of aberrations, maybe a little more, you might say they're knee-jerk aberrations, or high one year, low the next year type things. Maybe this is weather, maybe this is something else. Don't know, but found this interesting. So, why is so much money spent, so much research done on nitrogen, and nitrogen on corn especially? So you've seen this before, but I wanted to show you, this is cotton, not much change over time. Soybeans, of course, is very low. Wheat, it's moderate. But there's another category of everything else. That's lawn, turf, you name it. It's about equivalent to how much is spent on corn. So there's a lot of nitrogen that's out there, but yet a lot of the research has gone into corn. Why is that? Well, part of that is driven by the fact that we've got this Gulf of Mexico down there with hypoxic problems, and we've got a targeted area in the Midwest where a lot of corn is produced, and this area drains about 40% of the U.S. So somebody's to blame. And so corn production catches a lot of heat for this. Now, many of you in the audience have been involved in various kinds of nutrient rate time form studies. These were started back in the 50s, maybe before. They're ongoing today. Yesterday and today, I saw numerous studies like this. And a lot of these today are slanted toward environmental implications. And many of these are toward nitrogen. Now, this starburst that I show here, I did that for a reason, because I think that each one of these points on there represents a discipline, a specialty, something that you folks are doing. You are contributing to this understanding of this nitrogen puzzle. So here we are. I say, who's involved? It's ongoing. It's all of you. At the states, we've got commercial entities, seed companies, fertilizer dealerships. We've got consultants. Everybody's working on that. So I've just identified some of these disciplines. You may or may not be represented there, but it may be coming. And I'll just point out a couple of them. Dave Kissel gave this presentation 3 years ago. Dave was heavily involved in ammonia loss and volatilization type things. And some of his students are here. McGill, Richard Ferguson, Merle Vigil, they're here. So you should talk to them if you want to learn more about these things. What I didn't show here, there's another whole group of people that have contributed to this. These are the folks that developed the analytical procedures and made the interface now between the laboratory, the science that you conducted, and yet there's another group that I say, take it to the field type things. Variable rate, that's sort of the new technology. But I wanted to highlight a couple things in this analytical side of things. Those of you who are here from Denmark or Danish, it was Johan Keldahl who developed the procedure that many of us used in the laboratory. Not used so much anymore, but that was done a long, long time ago. Back in the 1970s, a lot of the laboratories started borrowing information or borrowing technology from the hospitals, the medical industry, and this is where the technicons, the flow injectors, that sort of thing came into play. All the way along, we've had mass spectrometers that were massive, huge devices, and over time they've become refined. And finally, they were able to harness, to put together, the Dumas combustion procedure. That's an old procedure also, very old, but once they were able to integrate it, now we had a way of taking a dry sample and directly feeding it into a mass spectrometer, and helped us understand a lot about nitrogen cycling. People use loss on ignition now as a substitute for some of the other ways, Buckley Black, to get away from some of the health and safety issues. The newer approaches, I wanted to mention this because we heard a lot of talk about the difference between extraction of nutrients versus the exchange of nutrients. And one of the ways that this can happen is with some kind of exchange resin. There were some papers downstairs today talking about using exchange resins. Other procedures. On the other end, when do we take the samples and how do we do it? We've got, going back to Fred Magdoff, pre-side-dress nitrogen test developed for basically manure situations. Fred Blackmore brought this to Iowa, where they've got a different kind of manure, stinky kind, swine manure. And then Greg Benford's here, I think. But at the end of the season, they developed a post-mortem test that is quite widely used. It's available to understand whether or not you did a good job or not. Maybe you don't want to know, but it's a usable test. And once again, I mentioned the exchange resins that can be used in situ to see what's happening over time. In terms of variable rate technologies, we're not going to go through all these. I'm just going to say that many of these were enabling technologies, pieces of the puzzle that relate to nitrogen. But I will say that the first one, this was back in the early 80s. Bob Beckert might have been involved in some of the other groups, but those folks didn't have GPS. So can you imagine making variable rate applications without GPS? You drive straight, you drive at the same speed, you time things, and it was a bit of a nightmare. So, but if you go down the line now, we've added GPS, we've added GIS, we've got some examples there. Ways to manage the data, software packages, we've got remote sensing, we've got electrical conductivity, ways to measure salts in the soil, a group of crop canopy sensors and chlorophyll meters many of you have used. We've heard about algorithms and ways to transform the information into a recommendation. And lo and behold, we've got these UAVs out there flying around that have potential and concerns. That's all I'm going to say about those. But then I found it curious as I started thinking about this, is all this research took a lot of money. Where did it come from? Who did it? Who provided it? Of course, you can expect that industry would expect to get some return on this. But for the other sources of money and other concerns, they were all out there. And so I'm going to use some examples of maybe how these sources of money directed where the nitrogen research went. I put this in there to remind me. Over the last 2 weeks now, we've been entertained by the College World Series. You think about who was involved, the pitcher and the batter. They were in the spotlight at various times, maybe only momentarily, but if that ball was hit, all of a sudden there were nine people who might be in the right place at the right time. And it may have taken a couple of them to make the play, to make it work out favorably. But if you were a base runner, You probably had a coach, somebody advising you, telling you what to do, helping you out. There were managers of the team helping to do the strategizing. And in a broader sense, we had, in the case of the World Series, we had two teams. We had competition. We have that. In a little broader sense, we have the sport. Sport of baseball. And so there are people involved all throughout this that have been involved in mentoring, coaching, playing. You might be in the spotlight, or you might be in a situation where you're on the team, and they, as a team, they expect you to do your part, do your best. And so some of the examples I'm going to offer here, they're things that I'm aware of. You will be aware of other examples. But back in the early 70s, the guys with EPA actually had white hats. They didn't have guns, but they had white hats, and they were funding some of the original water quality research related to nitrogen in pastureland runoff and then agland runoff. But you remember I told you about Prof. Olson saying, you guys are going to crap up the groundwater. That was happening. And so EPA said, we're going to put some money into this. So this was the first groundwater project that EPA funded. They really didn't want their name associated with it, so they ran the money through, at that time was Ag Stabilization and Conservation Service. So it was cost-sharing to the farmers. They cost-shared on irrigation wells, and I'll spend a little time on this, but only tell you that in fact, what they found was that some of the farmers were putting on a reasonable amount of water and others had no idea how much water they were putting on. You turn it on and you only shut it off if you had a big rain. So they were putting on a tremendous different amount of water. They also had field strips where they would put on the recommended rate of fertilizer and 50 pounds above and 50 pounds below. At one point, I remember Richard Ferguson was involved in this and his technician. They did a tally. One out of 200 had a yield reduction with 50 pounds less. And so all of a sudden, people realized, oh, we better give some credit to nitrate and irrigation water. When we talked to farmers then about reducing fertilizer rates and being a little more judicious, they said, oh, this is fine, but if you want us to cut back on nitrogen, you're going to have to provide us with a way to identify the problem so that we don't have a yield reduction, and then a way to go fix it. Well, at this point, I was involved in this project, and I said, oh, I need a mentor. I need some help. I knew that Dick Hageman, a plant physiologist at Illinois, was going to retire. And so I went to see Dick. And he says, yeah, you can come. You can come and we'll talk. So there's a picture of Dick and his lovely wife. Went back and I spent some time with him. At the time, Fred Below, you're in the audience. Fred was also my mentor. We worked together. We learned a lot. The take-home lesson for me, folks, was Dick Hageman says, you need to measure chlorophyll. That's what you've got to work on that one. So when I came back to Nebraska now, this is one of these dumb luck situations. One of the administrators had come to Ag Campus and said, you know, we have a railroad out here that is interested in funding some research. And they had heard about this EPA project, the EPA project, high nitrate in the groundwater and all that stuff. They might be interested in funding a project. So Richard and I and three or four more sat down, as I recall. One of the guys drafted up a page and a half of kind of a basic idea what might be involved. Gave it to the university administrator. A couple days later, here he comes with $1 million. Burlington Northern Railroad stepped up and Things like that don't happen anymore. But anyway, this was a three-year project involving entomology, irrigation, herbicides, this sort of thing. But this was the beginning of us now working with nitrogen concentration, chlorophyll content, leaves, this sort of thing. The problem was that what we found was that there was some differences between years. And we didn't know quite how to handle that. But we knew one of Prof. Olson's graduate students who happened to work for Pioneer. And so he was willing to step up, and for 4 or 5 years then, he was willing to help us collect samples from different locations and N rates and all this kind of stuff, as you can imagine. We developed a leaf punch that would take two punches side by side, one bottle for chlorophyll, one for nitrogen. And so we had all kinds of data after a little while. We would sample up and down the plant. That became useful later. But just as many of you saw yesterday in the papers, we had all kinds of shapes and curves in these nitrogen response functions. And at one point, I don't know why I did it, but anyway, we decided, let's try to normalize this stuff. That's what we did, and it turned out to work very well. Tended to linearize things, and then once we got into the business of the MESA project, I'll talk about in a minute, working with Todd Peterson and others, we said, well, hell, this is going to work for us for the sufficiency index, relative yield, the N-rich strip idea. So this is largely where it came from. But a couple years after that, one of the graduate students did a literature search of sorts. And so what we did was not all that novel. Back in the 1920s, somebody in Cornell or someplace back there, I don't remember where, they made a comment in their conclusion statement that they were comparing fertilizer rates. They were comparing fertilizer rates, and they said, perhaps one of the best ways to analyze this over time is to make a relative comparison. Nothing happened beyond that. Again, in the 40s, somebody was working to determine the critical level of nutrients in plants, and they made a similar comment. And so what we did was nothing novel, just it happened, and it seemed to work well. It was in 1990 that, between 80s and 90s, there was a lot of background discussions that I was not aware of. You might have been, but it all related back to water quality, what's happening. And what this brought about was this MESA project concept. So this was a presidential initiative, opened it up to 12 states, and requested requests for proposals. When it was all said and done, these were the 5 states. Now, I happen to know that Ron Follett was on the evaluation committee, and maybe some of you also. But anyway, these are the 5 states that were involved. A couple of unique things about it at the time, of these 12 states and why they were targeted is that at that time, 80% of the corn production was from those 12 states, and they were using 53% of the nitrogen. So we sort of targeted and identified a potential problem. The concern was nitrate and atrazine at the time. The unique issue was that to get the money, you had to have a partnership, a team between USDA and university researchers. And that probably played a part in who got the money. The other critical thing was, who were the coaches? Who were in the background helping us? Here we go. Leo Walsh was one of them. Chuck Onstead, the other from the ARS side. So we had lots of help. These are some of the people involved, and you'll recognize some of their names. But the point to remember maybe is that working together, these projects each got $1 million per year to be split between two entities, USDA and the university, for 5 years. It's a lot of work. At the end of 5 years, of course, the university folks, there were a lot of other people out here. Where's mine? And so the university side funding declined, but ARS funding continued. So that helped promote a lot more of the nitrogen research. One of the things that came out of this was the SPAD meters. Many of you have used these. These became available in 1990. Some of you know Dick Fox. He was involved in the testing of these stickers before they were commercialized. Another little tidbit is that a cousin to these meters was developed by the Japanese, by Minolta, for the purpose of determining if a car had been repainted. What's the thickness of the paint? And so a version of this meter was used for that purpose. One of the tidbits. The other thing that, coming from the nitrogen side of things, that was sort of painful to admit, was that you got to take care of water management if you hope to do very much in terms of good nitrogen management. So I had to admit that to my ag engineering colleague. Now, an off-the-cuff type crazy thing was that at Nebraska they installed multi-level water samplers down through the aquifer. And there was a laboratory in Canada that could tell you how old the water is. And so it was based on deuterium analysis type things. The water coming from about 20 meters deep was 19 years old. The water up at the top part of the aquifer, 3 months old. Todd Peterson was part of this. Talk to him about it. I think he had a good time. Anyway, this was really the beginning, guys, of a snowball activity. We were in the right place at the right time, just like a baseball player. We were there. It happened. We didn't have to move much. It just happened. So EPA had the idea that precision agriculture, it's something new. It has a potential now to reduce nitrate leaching to the groundwater. So they funded a winner-take-all competition. Well, we were in the right place at the right time. And so Richard Ferguson, Gary Hergert, Todd, we were all involved. Once again, it happened. It also happened that one of the guys from Farmland Industries, one of the scouts, says, I'll be glad to scout that field for you, just to understand what's going on. And so this all happened, and the next spring I got a phone call from a couple guys that I didn't know. They said, we'd like to have you help us find some research sites in Nebraska. Okay, let's go. We ended up out at Clay Center, Nebraska, at the Burlington Northern site. The one that had been established by the railroad was available. And so this was Resource 21. Once again, Todd was involved. And Dale Lycom, some of the other folks. But the upshot of this was that for the first year, it worked really well with the university. And they came back and they said, we'd like to expand this to other crops now. Where can we go? So I gave them some names, and a little while later they came back and the long face, and he says, this is going to cost us a lot more than we thought. Overhead costs were a little high. And plus they said, working up all these agreements is going to be a killer. How do we get around this? Is there a way? And I said, well, you might be able to go to USDA, ARS, and pull this thing off with one agreement and let them take care of distributing the money and finding the people. That's what happened. And so these are the people that were involved. You'll notice that they have different expertises. Jerry Hatfield was heavily involved. Some of you, other ones, I don't know if Steve Moss is here. But anyway, we were in the right place again at the right time. This brought in about $2 million. And a lot of equipment that's very expensive. A couple things we learned or verified was what wavelengths are important to monitor chlorophyll and biomass. The folks in Texas developed IRT thermometers for determining canopy temperature. They're now available downstairs through Delta T, I believe it is, that information. But one of the interesting things was, even though Resource 21 could develop and provide farmers with a package of pictures and maps and all this kind of stuff, if the farmers didn't find value in it and weren't ready to make a decision, they weren't going to pay for it. It's not different today. But what it did was the information and the graduate students that were involved provided the background then for the sensor work. So we'll talk a little bit about sensors, but we got to go back. We have to go back to 1982. Some of you will remember the soil doctor. Out of curiosity, how many of you remember soil doctor? Oh, quite a few. Some of you might have even received a letter. You might have been a little bit vocal about how this technology worked and might have gotten a letter that says, be more polite. Anyway, that happened. It moved on. The science found out that it's really electrical conductivity. Along the way, we've talked about chlorophyll meters as one of the nitrogen proxy meters. Canopy sensors came about, and I'm going to say a little bit about two approaches, one from Nebraska, one from Oklahoma. And initially, the two groups, we didn't know the other one was working on these things. The Oklahoma approach, they had a problem with winter wheat production. They had poor seed establishments, so poor germination, this sort of thing, in some cases dry soil. They had winter kill problems, so they didn't want to be fertilizing bare soil. So that was the impetus for them to get into the sensor business. Nebraska, we didn't have the density problem, but we had vigor and color problems. So there were sort of two different approaches. The point I wanted to make is none of this would have happened, folks. None of it would have happened if it hadn't been for teams. Bill put together a team with ag engineers who had the ability to build the sensors and to build the tractors and whatever to make it work. We weren't so fortunate in Nebraska, but in another way, we had graduate students, we had access to Licor down the street a ways. That was very helpful. And we had the USDA team that still had some of this MESA money. So we could put together a different kind of team. In the end, what we have now are active crop canopy sensors. They're available, and they're out there. We won't say any more about them. We also want to remember that EM38 is a proxy. It's here. It's been demonstrated to be useful. So it's one of these substitute or proxies for nitrogen. Going way back, many of you will remember Jeff Wagonette. And Jeff was instrumental in developing one of the first models that dealt with water, soil, and in this case it was wheat. But now over time, other people have developed models to specifically deal with things like irrigation, nitrate leaching, carbon-nitrogen dynamics, nitrogen, I'll call it N-LEAP, the N-LEAP model that Ron Follett and Marv Schaefer worked on, It was a team effort. Elijah Huza, another team effort, and that included both USDA and university and industry people. Recently, from the nitrogen, or from the plant side, they've gone back and added nitrogen to a plant growth model. And so we've got a variety of models out there that can be used for decision aids. From the nitrogen tool side of things, I've listed some things like AdaptN. That's a soil-based approach. Farmer's Edge is one that uses NDVI information that, in turn, they use the technologies developed by Oklahoma State University. Many of these states now have spreadsheets for making these nitrogen recommendations and helping farmers come up with economic determinations. And just today we heard about a number of products by Monsanto, by Climate Corp, by Pioneer. They're out there, they're evolving, I think. One of the things that's interesting is that some of the folks in a number of states have said, we don't find a relationship necessarily between nitrate in the soil and the yield we're going to get. And so they sort of said, let's rethink this whole thing. And so now the group of states, they break their states into categories related to soil type and climate. And so it's a different approach now to making recommendations. Just a little bit about what we're going to do with this data, how it's presented, and then we'll be done. I'm going to use an example here of a nitrogen response function and how it might be presented to producers or to the public. So if you say, well, I put on 200 kilos of nitrogen, for every dollar I spend on fertilizer, in this case, with this is $4 corn, 50 cent nitrogen, 55 cent, I think. But anyway, you know, it looks very positive. I get $4 or $5 back. That's a good deal. The farmers might say, well, a little bit of insurance nitrogen surely won't hurt anything. But if you do an analysis now closer to the maximum yield, what you find is that if you go over, it's going to cost you big time. If you go under, it'll make you a little bit. There's some conservation involved. We've heard about calculating maximum economic yield. I've done that here. And in this case, it doesn't make a lot of difference which side you go. It's pretty much the same. So this is a good approach. But if you take it a little bit further and do a recovery of nitrogen based on the information, for each one of these rates, I've picked out and shown you what the recovery is. These are not the numbers we're talking to the public about. What we're talking about is, on the average, 45% nitrogen use efficiency, and that's probably the best we can do. So what's going to happen when the public starts to understand a bit more about incremental nitrogen and that last unit of fertilizer you apply? What's its efficiency? What could it be doing to the environment? A couple more things that, as agronomists, as soil scientists, whatever, many times we'd like to think we can solve the problems of the world. But I wanted to point out to you is, early on, they pointed out that this fertilizer was too expensive, the anhydrous ammonia approach. The engineers were involved in developing better techniques and procedures. And actually, back in the mid-80s, there were graduate students in North Dakota that were working to have a dual injection of nitrogen and phosphorus, something that we now find very common. But the problems they were having was inconsistent results because of metering. The tank pressure was changing throughout the day because of ambient temperature, and a for heaven's sake, distribution across the toolbar. All these problems. Well, about the 90s, they brought on the thermal cooling, the cold flow type approach to at least try to keep the nitrogen in the liquid form so you could meter it. But it didn't necessarily solve the other problems with tank pressure or distribution. And this is where a Caterpillar engineer came into play. They now manufacture, they've patented the procedure, 98, of pressurizing the nitrogen, the phosphorus, whatever else you want to put together. And they put orifices in the system, much like a diesel engine, or your fuel-injected engines now, to provide the uniformity and metering. Costs more money, but it's available. So we're almost done. Where are we at today? If you take a look at the U.S., 46% of the nitrogen is still used on corn, 11% on wheat. These north central states, once again, 91% of the nitrogen is applied to corn. We still have the situation there. So we're going to have to do something about that. We're under the scope. I went through the papers, the posters. There's a lot of papers downstairs talking about nitrous oxide emissions, hypoxia. Those aren't going to go away. These are some of my concerns that I think we're going to have to pay more attention to these things. If you doubt that, you can look on the website for Tulane Prize. Just take a look. And someplace along the line, I saw the message that said, it's $1 million prize waiting for somebody, but it's a $1 trillion problem that we're trying to address. So it's going to be a challenge. I've listed some of the problems that are probably going to need to be overcome, and some of the opportunities. We've got to synchronize, better utilize manure. We've potentially got problems with the fertilizer infrastructure, with storage, distribution, those kind of things. Opportunities for adaptive management, use of cover crops, maybe wetlands, different solutions to different problems. So I think these are opportunities. And if you really doubt this, think about what Walmart, General Mills, some of these companies are talking about is providing the customers with information about how good you're doing, how good the farmers are doing. And once the farmers, or once the customers start to learn about how good they could be doing, they're going to want more and more. So we need to be ready to step up. We're going to end with a bang. This is trivia. But there have been a couple big explosions because of nitrogen. One was in Germany, took out one of their big plants. But the biggest one was probably in 1947. This was a French ship being loaded with ammonium nitrate fertilizer. And the website says that they observed some smoke coming out of one of the, I'll say, the bins type things. And there were lots of no smoking signs around, but they knew also that the workers were puffing now and then. Well, when they saw the smoke coming out, the manager said, we don't want to put water on this because it'll ruin the fertilizer. Just close the doors and we'll suffocate it. Well, that didn't solve the trick. After a little while, 2,300 ton of anhydrous ammonia went bang. And some of the windows got blown out a long ways away, shock waves 250 miles away, various things here, 15-foot high wave of water. A whole bunch of things happened. More recently, we had Oklahoma State's federal building, or Oklahoma City federal building, that put an end to ammonium nitrate utilization in terms of fertilizers. And then more recently, the issue of not necessarily reporting or storing or who knows what all happened there, but another issue. Finally, I'd like to end with the dark days of nitrogen. They say that World War I would have ended a lot sooner if the Germans had not been able to make synthetic saltpeter for their gunpowder. It would have ended a lot quicker. Even more tragic was that they figured out how to make cyanide, which was used in the death camps. We've already talked about nitrate from one source or another ending up in the Gulf of Mexico, not all because of fertilizers, not all because of nitrogen. And hydrous ammonia is used in crazy ways, the production of methamphetamines. And finally, the last one might get a snicker. The military announced that they are going to stop using saltpeter and putting it in food. With that, folks, I hope you voted. I hope you enjoy the rest of the meeting. And I want to especially thank Leo Walsh for his leadership, his generosity. I want to thank and compliment you for a great effort. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank the authors, co-authors, and reviewers of the folks who helped us put together the monograph, Nitrogen in Agricultural Systems. So with that, thank you.
Thank you. We'll try to take time for one or two questions. We're running a little bit late. We'll try a couple.
Maybe not. They're all hungry. Yeah.
All hungry. Okay. Go ahead. Sure. No questions. Okay.
Wait. Just one comment, Jim.
Okay.
That picture with that color forest in Mississippi was a white view. Georgia stop was a little bitty thing. That 1931.
Everybody hear that? A white mule? And were your relatives behind the mule? Okay, thank you.
Jim, in appreciation for being our Leo Walsh lecturer for the 2014 meetings, we're presenting you with this plaque.
Thanks again, everyone. This has been fun. It's been intimidating, but more than anything, it's been fun. I hope there was something in it for you.
Thanks, Jim. That was a great job.